Good afternoon and welcome to UK Column viewers and listeners. I have a very special guest with me today. I think this is going to be a really interesting interview. It's brought a lot of things to my mind, things that I was looking at personally many years ago. But this particular individual has got a really fascinating background and has also done a lot of work on a number of publications and more recently on a book. And we're going to be talking not only about his background, but also the work on that book. And I think that's going to lead us into some really interesting subjects around society in the West and how we've seen major changes and what some of those causes for those changes are. So I'm going to welcome straight away Dr. J. Michael Waller. Thank you very much for being with us today.
It's great to be with you, Brian.
I think the easiest way to introduce you is just to pop up your own CV from your website, because you've really done such a huge amount. But it says here that you're presently president of Georgetown Research, a political risk and private intelligence company in Washington, D.C. You're a senior analyst for strategy at the Center for Security Policy, founding editorial board member of NATO's peer-reviewed Defense Strategic Communications Journal. That's 2015-18. You hold a PhD in international security affairs from Boston University. And interestingly, you've received your military training as an insurgent with the Nicaraguan Democratic Force, Contras. For 13 years, you were the Walter and Leonora Annenberg Professor of International Communication at the Institute of World Politics in Washington, D.C., where you designed and taught the world's only graduate program on public diplomacy and political warfare. And if I add a little bit to that from the Center for Security Policy, because that mentions that you were an instructor with the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And I'm inclined to pop that in because we've got some relations who live in that area. And I'm delighted to say I visited, but I didn't. I don't know where the school was or whether it's still in existence in Monterey. But a fascinating CV. Over to you. Add anything that I've missed. And also just tell us a little bit about yourself. And I think you're going to be leading into a remarkable career, which seemed to begin in a church.
It did. It began very unusually. In this case, I was an undergraduate at George Washington University in the in 1983, so Reagan's first term, and the through a series of sort of accidents or fortuitous circumstances, I was recruited as a student into the CIA to collect intelligence on Soviet support for international communist movements, guerrilla terrorist movements in the Western Hemisphere, so on the American southern border. Later on, I was part of a group that infiltrated and disrupted Soviet international front organizations, and this was at the peak of the Soviet active measures campaign against American and British nuke military modernization. So it was through these unusual experiences and personal connections that I was able to get a look at life inside the U.S. Intelligence services. I was not an intelligence officer. I was not an employee of the CIA, but I worked directly for CIA Director Casey through a cutout, through a privately funded network that it turns out he was funding out of his pocket because he didn't trust the CIA bureaucracy to be able to do its job.
And can I just reflect back that from many years ago, I did 21 years in the Navy, which was principally the Cold War era. So I left in 93, but most of my time had been Cold War. And I do remember sending off the odd signal, usually of something innocuous like the weather, which went to Langley, Virginia. And there was a certain amount of intelligence material which I handled, and part of your book actually got me thinking about that time. I'll just throw in now, that was to do with the problems with the Walker brothers, who shared a lot of secrets with the Russians at a particular point. And I saw the huge effect that had made. But I'll just echo that back, because my only contact with the depth of the intelligence services that you've been connected with and working with was just those sort of fairly innocent signals to Langley, Virginia. But there we are. So where do we go? Just tell us a bit more about what you got out of your time with the Contras, because that, from what I've read, was a key part in your journey to getting closer to the intelligence infrastructure in the US.
It was one of those formative life experiences where you're a kid, so you don't really know where it's going to go or even why you're doing some things at the time. I wanted to be involved in a mission-oriented activity, and given the Army Reserve Officers Training Corps a bit of a try, and then decided even before basic training that the Army wasn't doing anything. It was run by a lot of depressed Vietnam veteran colonels, and I thought, I've got to go and do something else. So this opportunity came up to go to Central America with the Nicaraguan Contras. I had friends who had gone to Angola with the forces of Jonas Savimbi, and in the north with the forces of Holden Roberto. I had met journalists and others who had been to Afghanistan with the Northern Alliance, with the forces of Ahmad Shah Massoud and others. And so I thought, well, this is a chance for me to do the right thing against the Soviets in my own way, because I spoke Spanish, and be involved in mission-oriented activity at the same time. So it was the beginning of a big lifetime vocation to oppose not just the Soviets, but their allies, and later on the jihadists and the Chinese communists.
I'm going to use the word challenging. That must have been quite a challenging thing to do, because the story you narrate is that you weren't even sure who you were going to meet when you got out there, but you did remember the name of a particular individual.
This was my first trip down with the Contras in Honduras. So you'd enter Nicaragua through Honduras. I was an illegal alien in two countries. One of them was Nicaragua. And in going down, I just went wasn't making any progress getting in, because I was this skinny American kid with, you know, kind of longish hair. And I looked like one of the Marxist fellow travelers who was going down to join some revolutionary movement and cause trouble. And so I pulled rank, not getting any cooperation at the border. And I asked the Honduran authorities for Captain Luque. And they seemed kind of puzzled and went into another room, and finally somebody came out and allowed my friend and I through. And then there we met up with the Nicaraguan Contras. But it wasn't for another 30 years that I realized that I was Capitan Luque. And that cryptonym that had been given to me in church back in 1980, late 83, early 84, by CIA Director Casey himself. I'd been told prior to my trip to go to St. Matthew's Cathedral to the 5 o'clock vigil mass. And I'm a Catholic. And I thought, well, this is a strange way to get me back to church. Maybe this is some much more dangerous run than I thought I was going to do down in Central America. So I went anyway. And Casey shuffled up right at the end of, at the end of mass. I was told to stay still, don't move until somebody approached me. And then his staff approached me, and then he did. And he mumbled something at me, and I didn't understand what it was. And then somebody else barked at me, Capitan Luque, remember that name. It was a very commanding voice, so I remembered the name. And it was in church, and Casey left. And I learned much later on that Casey went and did this in church. He went to Mass almost every day because he could never be forced to testify before Congress or a court what happened in church.
No, fascinating. An incredible start to a career. So you get that experience with the Contras. And then from my reading of your CV, you slowly but surely get involved closer with intelligence organizations. But at a particular point, you're obviously writing as well. Before we get into that, just a little question, because I had a look at your LinkedIn page and under your name, it says national security professional with, quote, unconventional views, unquote. So what would those views be? You've presumably put that on your LinkedIn page, but you're here with a background in the establishment. Where did the unconventional views come from?
Well, it's not so much, philosophical views, which are different from the mainstream, but it's more of a worldview. So I've never fit into a bureaucracy and never really been part of one for very long and never in the federal government. And I was told early on that with somebody with my temperament, my sense of being mission-oriented and not fitting into a routine or something that's regimented, that in the words of one Senate staffer who was on the Intelligence Committee, you will hate them and they will hate you. And of course, that's no way to go into public service. So I chose a different route on my own as part of mainly privately funded or exclusively privately funded networks to finish up the Cold War against the Soviet bloc. This is a time when Reagan and Thatcher were ruling the Western world and had a real mission, and I wanted to be part of that mission.
Right.
So the unconventional views came from not fitting in, not going by the typical processes and being content to be rotated through bureaucracies all my life. And in so doing, looking at things from sort of an insurgent standpoint. So in the U.S., we look at things as from a very large perspective, where you spend colossal amounts of money and work many, many, many years, including an entire career, on a problem, often without really solving the problem, ameliorating it a bit, but not really solving it. And we have insane amounts of money to just throw at things. So my experience with the Contras and with some small privately funded networks was that it's remarkable how much you can do with very little money, if you're forced to think that way.
Right.
So that was my unconventional view, how to have low-cost, high-impact solutions to some of our pressing problems.
How did you get from that background into what appears to be a specialist area of psychological warfare, if I've picked that up correctly?
Yeah, this, again, came from that same time period. So the Soviets were building up a massive nuclear weapons force. The U.S. and the U.K. were trying to catch up with modernizing their nuclear forces. And the Soviets sponsored a global active measures campaign, a political warfare campaign, a psychological warfare campaign to prevent the West from modernizing. And I was looking at that and seeing how effective this was, certainly in delaying programs and even shutting some of them down. And I had gone infiltrated some of these groups to see what was going on, who was behind them, who was with them, what their themes were, what they were planning. So I get to see how cheap their operations were, yet how effective they were in tying the hands of people like Reagan and Thatcher. And then the same thing with the Contras, taking an insurgent perspective of this and then looking at the communist FMLN guerrillas in neighboring El Salvador and how they were almost able to take over the country based not so much on a military insurgency, but in a political and psychological warfare campaign, a global one, right. That I chose this as an area of concentration. How can we in the West do this better so we don't have to waste so much money on the military?
You've got that understanding and you've got that philosophy. How did you manage to move across to be teaching at pretty high level these sorts of topics? How did that start for you?
Well, again, it started out once you do something, you find yourself in a situation, there's nobody managing you or directing you or often even guiding you, and you sort of become noticed or you fall into things and opportunities arise. So in my case, there was a dean of the College of Communication at Boston University called me up. He had been a journalist before, and he said, hey, can you tell me more about the El Salvador insurgency and how it works on the political side? So I helped him. I gave him a lot of information to write something on it. And then he said, do you have a graduate degree? I said, no. He said, would you like to come up here to get a master's degree, all expenses paid? I said, sure. Just starting out in life with a, you know, I had just gotten married. And so, sure, I'll take a fully paid college degree, master's degree. And from that went, it became a doctoral degree. And then from that, it entered naturally the teaching area. So there was a graduate school being set up for U.S. national security affairs, but it also had the curious idea of defensive Western traditional values and principles. And then I became a professor of international communication at that school and was able to apply much of what I had learned in practice as an academic discipline.
When did the connection, for example, with teaching in Monterey, when did the military tuition come into that time frame?
So that was after the September 11th, 2001 attacks, when we were faced with what was called the Global War on Terror. And there had to be some kind of a traveling group of instructors to go from military base to military base, you know, all the way from Virginia to Hawaii, to train senior non-commissioned officers and junior officers in various areas of discipline prior to their deployment to Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere around the world. So this was done for the Army, but through the Naval Postgraduate School.
Interesting, fascinating. You've written a book, Big Intel, and it's an extremely interesting book. You were kind enough to send us an electronic copy of this, which I've spent quite a bit of time reading. I've got to be honest, I haven't got through every single chapter word for word, but I have spent a lot of time on your book because I found it so interesting. And a couple of names came up, which I'll just throw at you now, because of course Marx is in there and Gramsci's in there and Saul Alinsky appears. And when I was getting near those particular mentions, I suddenly thought, wow, this is really interesting where this book is going. So the title is Big Intel, and the subtitle there is How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. And a lot of detail in the book. You've got a lot of information about particularly the FBI and the CIA in America and intelligence services in general. But through it is a historical theme, which is largely connected into various forms of communism, and in particular, communist subversive techniques. So Yuri Bezmenov gets quite a big mention. Some people know him as Thomas Schumann, and also Gramsci, who I've mentioned, and the Frankfurt School. So I'm going to call you Mike, if I may. Mike, what got you to the position where you thought, I've just got to write a book?
First of all, I didn't want to write the book. I was sick of Washington. Been there since 1980 for the most part, with a few breaks here and there. And I just wanted to be done with everything. And finally, some of those closest to me said, you can't just turn your back. You have to, you know, people need what you know. So there was that part. And then the publisher, Regnery, whose editor-in-chief had been my roommate back when I was doing stuff in Central America with the Contras and with the Salvadoran army, He called me out of the blue and said, you have to write a book on the CIA. He didn't know my involvement. Nobody knew my involvement with the CIA back in the 1980s. So it was through that I wrote the book, but it was only supposed to be about the CIA under Obama, Trump, and Biden. And then it expanded to, the FBI, because it's got such a greater effect on the American public. But then also, once you're trying to find the origins of all this. It just didn't start with Obama. How did it begin? What were the roots of that? So what were the ideological drivers and who were the people behind it? So then that became Big Intel going back a century.
That's extremely interesting, because the Biden-Obama is the latter section of the book, isn't it? It's from my memory, I think it's about chapter 20 onwards. So that was the bit that captured you. And then the historical bit came later. And you've put the thing together in that way. Yeah, it's very, very interesting. So I want to say that reading the book, there's two distinct things going on. You're talking about the organization of intelligence and, well, CIA intelligence and the FBI in America. You're also talking about a strong thread of communism and communist subversive techniques. You're seeing those techniques impact not only on American society, but you're seeing those techniques start to impact on the very American institutions which are supposed to be protecting America from communist subversive techniques. So there's a number of different threads which weave themselves together in the book. But ultimately, I think the book is about a warning that something malevolent is happening to US society. Would that be correct?
Yes, to both of our societies. The parallels are really striking because the whole Frankfurt School mentality that drove, that incubated and created critical theory, and then the critical theorists, and the whole idea that you take the whole concept of Marxism, you get rid of the economic warfare side of it. So it's no longer the poor masses of people against the wealthy elites, because right now, so many of the wealthy elites themselves are Marxists. So what are you attacking? So it's this constant search of an oppressor, a constant victim mentality, and then a constant incessant attack on our civilization, the roots of our civilization, our institutions, our forms of government, our respective forms of government, because both are rooted in what are sort of white, male, misogynistic, racist oppression that have to be overthrown. And along with being overthrown, anything to do with Christian religion, anything to do with family, nuclear family, values, rule of law along the you know, Anglo-Saxon kind. All those things have to be destroyed in the name of diversifying, in the name of creating a more equitable and inclusive society. This is critical theory based on the cultural form of Marx, which he wrote about even before he wrote the Communist Manifesto. So, you know, people really don't understand it, but in the US and the UK, our intelligence services are suffering from those common origins where you had the services had been penetrated deeply by the Soviets, but it was those very same Soviet agents, Dickie Ellis, Kim Philby, and others, who helped the United States set up Office of Strategic Services during World War II, the precursor to the CIA. And so we still suffer from this contamination today.
A lot in there again. Question I'd like to, it's your opinion on this, because if we're following the roots of this poison back, we're gonna quickly come back to Marx. And so we're talking about when are we talking about 1843. And Marx was living in the West, but the ideology being generated is, we're going to say, a communist ideology. And he is able to expand that ideology because of support he gets from the West. And then we see Marx helping to kickstart off revolution in Russia and the formation ultimately of the Soviet state. And the point that I'm sort of circling around is that on one hand, we can sit here in 2024 and say the threat against us is the communist threat, and that threat is aligned with Russia and China. Or we could say the threat that we're facing is the communist threat, and that has been created from people and organizations within our own societies. Which one is correct, or which one would you support? What's your view on it?
Well, Marx and Engels began as Europeans who elaborated on ideologies based in the extreme parts of the French Revolution, and then certain philosophical schools of thought behind that. So they didn't have state sponsorship for this. In fact, they were being sponsored by the Engels family's capital in the British mills. So it's kind of ironic that the ones who were denouncing the oppression of the workers were actually being funded by the mill family that was supposedly oppressing workers. So they profited from that to develop their philosophy. But the Soviets built on this, and they realized right away, the Bolsheviks, that they couldn't replicate the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 in Europe and abroad, because workers there had too much hope ahead of them. They had real possibilities, so they were not going to have some kind of an armed proletarian struggle. And that's when there was a meeting in 1922 in Moscow, where you had the leaders of the European Communist parties and the head of the Soviet apparatus to manage them, and the head of the Cheka, which became the KGB, and they decided then and there to develop an institution in Germany that would tear apart societies culturally, put the societies at war with one another. This was in Weimar Germany. And the whole idea then, after Germany's unconditional surrender following World War I and the humiliation and the internal strife that followed, this institute, which was based in Frankfurt and got the nickname Frankfurt School, would exist to bring in the journalists and philosophers and cultural figures and others to find a way to tear Germany apart inside, so that then the communists could take over. Well, Hitler beat them to it, and so they were pushed out, and they set up their Frankfurt School, replanted Frankfurt School in New York at Columbia University, but also in the UK at Tavistock Institute, and then that's where they had their new schools of thought to elaborate on how to tear apart the UK and the British Empire at large and all of Anglo-Saxon society at large, how to do the same thing in the United States and elsewhere. Then it stopped being state-sponsored, though, and it started being a real train of thought that the public and scholars and journalists and others had internalized on their own. So you had a Soviet active measure that then took on a sort of a zombie-like existence of its own.
In your description there, we've got sort of two seeds, haven't we? We've got the seeds at work inside the Western world itself, and we've got the drive coming in following the Bolshevik revolution. And the techniques that you're talking about, also coming back to the Frankfurt School, but probably, would it be fair to say, the best description of these techniques is has probably come from Yuri Bezmenov in his description of these subversive techniques to be employed, as he said, back in the 80s by the KGB. He set those right out pretty strongly, didn't he?
He did, and he wasn't regarded very well at the time when he said it. He had a few people who the message resonated with him, and there were a few recordings of interviews and lectures that he made in around 1983-84, but his warnings never really took hold. And until people revived those videos and posted them up on YouTube, that Bezmenov got a very large following. So there's a whole chapter there on Bezmenov in Big Intel and what he said. And the reason I put it in there, I could have paraphrased him or simply quoted from him, but I went and transcribed his interviews, because someday YouTube is obviously going to take them down. I wanted to have some written record, which hadn't found elsewhere, about what he really said and warned about. And every single thing he warned about came true.
Yes, that's the powerful thing, isn't it? And I came across this man through a book which was called The EU Collective Enemy of Its Member States. And it was by a gentleman called Christopher Story, who unfortunately isn't live now. I did meet him in London. But he gave me a copy of his book, which was essentially on Soviet subversion of society. But in the first few pages, he included a table with the works of what he called from Thomas Schumann, Yuri Bezmenov, but he used the name Thomas Schumann. And it set out in a tabular form the areas of society and how they would be attacked and what the result was. And we had everything there from Christianity to education to social life, the trade unions, the military. And I was reading that book. I was at home. I particularly remember an afternoon of sat in the armchair with a cup of tea, looking through this table. And then I found myself saying, this is happening. This is happening in UK. And then as I got back into the table and read more, it was like a strange realization that breakdown, which I was watching in a number of areas of UK society at that time. What am I talking about? I'm going back to the early, it would have been the mid-1990s because I'd left the Navy at that stage. But the breakdown that I was seeing in society, strange changes, changes to language, I could see the description in that table, and that made a profound impact on me. And that's when I started to go looking for other people who were talking about where these techniques had come from, which of course starts to pull you back towards the Frankfurt School. So I'll just echo that back to you, that the European collective enemy of its member states, with a lot of detail about the Soviet regime and the people and the techniques, was where I first got interested in the subject. And that's why I say that when I began to read your book, I was just so drawn into it, because you, with a lot more experience than me in these fields, were absolutely going back into that man's very important work.
Where would we be, right, if we didn't have him giving those almost forgotten lectures from 40 years ago, and then the people who saw fit to post them for everybody to see now? They're really, their real value today is that we're not exploring unknown territory. Bezmenov is giving us a blueprint of what to look for in the different stages of attacks on society and the different stages of societal decline, so that we're not going blindly through this these internal crises that our respective countries are going through. And it's also helpful to know that these types of things are planned. So Bezmenov speaking to us from 40 years ago is letting us know that we're really on the mark when we're seeing different hidden hands, different ideological tendencies, and a deliberation of our societies from within, as opposed to simply changing social mores and new generations of people coming up with different ideas. This is a real attack that we're withstanding.
The other thing that he pointed out was that these were long-range plans, and one of the weaknesses of Western society in particular was that people tended to think in much shorter terms. So the Soviets were happy to be talking about what they could achieve in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, whereas the West tended to look at short-term plans. So they weren't looking at this longer, slower creeping ideology that had been unleashed.
Exactly. And even, you know, Bezmenov's predecessors back at that 1922 meeting in Moscow, they knew, and they even said to the effect that this is a strategy that will outlast our own lifetimes, and it will take many generations to continue. So then 50 years later, 50 years later, when Bezmenov is being trained as a Soviet propaganda agent, he was also trained, this will take generations to accomplish. And now, a generation or two later, we're seeing it, you know, in the state of collapse that it's in.
Yes. And the basic table, if I remember it correctly, it had 25 years, I think it was, of demoralization, followed by 5 years of destabilization. Then it was normalization, I think, which was the final synthesis into, breakdown, demoralization, destabilization, breakdown, and then normalization, which I believe was the synthesis into a communist society established within the West.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And something like it, because you people will often scoff today at the idea of communist society and communist revolution and so forth. But if you look at all the ideological drivers come from Marx, and they come from Georgi Lukács and the Frankfurt School and the Tavistock folks. So it all stems from the same origin. So it's just a different kind of revolution that was envisioned by the same people who brought us Bolshevism.
Okay, so here's the first challenging question. You've got this ideology which has been unleashed. You've seen it. You see it very clearly, so clearly that you're able to write a really detailed book about what's been happening. You've been working within the intelligence, in and alongside the intelligence services inside the United States. But apparently those people couldn't see what had been unleashed on them. How do you explain that?
That's a tough one. And those who were warning about it were generally not welcome. Even inside the intelligence services, there were some terrible arguments and debates, which you should have. Any good analytical team should have big debates and even bitter arguments in order to find the answers to things. But people with these types of views, even in the 80s, were viewed as anachronistic, old cold warriors, you know, something out of McCarthyism in the 1950s. So their views weren't really welcome. And as such, you didn't have a very good analytical base or a data base on which to learn what was happening to us. So fortunately for on the American side, we had Ronald Reagan and a team of people who did understand it, a CIA director, Bill Casey, who had served in the OSS, who did understand it, and some people around Reagan, some of whom had been former communists themselves, had been trained by the communists, they'd been groomed by them, and then they broke with them. And for decades had spent their lives combating it. These were the people who I learned under. And so you did have a pushback then, but you didn't have, like even to this day, our intelligence services don't have a sophisticated understanding of how other international ideological movements work. Whether it's the anarchists, whether it's certain jihadist movements, how they work and how they operate and how they will infiltrate and sort of hibernate when they need to function within the law. So they're not viewed as criminals, they're not viewed as subversives, they're not viewed as terrorists until such time as they come forward to become just that. So understanding ideological warfare has not been a very good way to enhance one's career in a bureaucracy, which is why, again, some of us never fit in.
Right. Okay. And your description of the impact of the ideological warfare is that it clearly started to impact on people within U.S. intelligence services and new people who were appointed into the system. So your book is indicating that you were able to observe, maybe with hindsight, but you were able to observe people within the defense, I'm going to call it the defense and intelligence realm of the United States, who had themselves been taken over by this ideology. They'd been subverted themselves by the ideology imposed on wider American society.
Right. And many of them didn't know it. They would become justifiably indignant because they didn't understand what was happening to them, what their experiences were that had influenced them. Just like at the time, I didn't know a lot of what I was seeing until many years later when I was able to sit back and put it together. But if you're in any kind of a bureaucracy, you're on deadlines, you have meetings, you have all sorts of things happening where, you know, time frames in which you must produce something. So you don't have a chance to sit back and to muse about, hey, what's going on around us? What's happening around us? There's no time for that. Yeah. You have all of these other benchmarks that you must meet. So on the one hand, it's difficult to have that perspective when you're in a day-to-day bureaucracy. On the other hand, also, it's not, it doesn't profit you to be a contrarian within a bureaucracy. That's not how you get promoted, or that's not how you get the types of work that duties that you need or that you want. And in fact, it's a good way to get punished. and to be set back, and either you're stationed to a very difficult and unpleasant, unprestigious hardship post, or you're simply put in a place where you'll become bored to death and they hope you'll either remain harmless or even leave government service. So this is one common thing. Now, when you combine that with an influx after 9/11 of a very large number of new analysts who view the world a very different way. So they don't view the world in the Western moral tradition anymore. They even view the world as a bad place. So the United States was founded by evil men who set up a constitutional order to, in their view, to make slavery something permanent and to exploit everybody. So the duty then of these new people is to defend the country and the world against the evils of this type of misogynistic, bigoted ideology.
Yeah.
And so when you have people who are sworn to uphold, in the case of the United States, to uphold the American Constitution, who don't believe in constitutional principles, then your country's really in trouble. And this is what we're facing in the CIA and the FBI today.
I really began to get interested with what you started to talk about. I've just got some notes here because there's so much detail. Chapter 21, which was entitled Manufacturing Domestic Threats, the Bounty System. And you started to talk about the FBI under Bush, Cheney, and Mueller. And you said it was becoming more centralized and more of a military format. So there were changes to the FBI happening. And then very quickly, the next person that emerges who you say made a step change to things was Obama. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you actually saw with those key political people and what you thought they were doing?
The FBI was set up so that the investigations were originated from the field offices in different cities. So they're initiated on the ground at any of the 56 different field offices. They're not initiated from central headquarters. And this is really important in our system because it's designed to prevent the central government from taking power over the states and over the individuals and abusing that power. Even under J. Edgar Hoover, who had, you know, plenty of issues of his own over his very long tenure at the FBI, he never even came near to committing the types of abuses that have been happening today. So after 9/11, President George W. Bush turned to his brand new FBI director, Robert Mueller, who had only been on the job for a week, and he pointed at him and said, "You will make sure this never happens in our country again." So Mueller, who had been a Marine, very distinguished attorney, said, "Fine, that's my orders from the president. I'm going to do it." So he turned the FBI from an investigative and law enforcement agency into a domestic intelligence service with police functions. And this in our system is a very dangerous thing. So he created 60 new top-level management positions. He centralized the Bureau from the top down instead of reversing it from having been the bottom up. And he hired a whole lot of new people who were very different from the ethos that the FBI had always had for its entire existence. And then what Bush did then was he centralized the domestic security organizations that had been dispersed throughout the bureaucracy, centered them under one gigantic Department of Homeland Security, then centralized the 18-agency intelligence community, which had been designed so that it would always be divided at the top and could never act against the constitutional government, centralized that under the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and then created a whole series of laws that were pushed through Congress, like the USA Patriot Act, that had very draconian powers. And some were so draconian that they were designed to sunset after a few years. They would expire so that they wouldn't become a threat. But instead, Congress kept renewing these laws. So you have all of these things together, created a large central apparatus with the force of law behind it. And it became a top-down security apparatus. So when somebody like Obama comes in who says that he plans to fundamentally transform the United States of America part of his fundamental transformation was to seize control of this central security apparatus that we have and to politicize it with the type of critical theory that has been tearing our society apart.
Would you say that what Obama clearly started to do, to me it's subversive, but maybe that's a bit strong, did he know what he was doing? Or was he doing this because he was being advised from people around him who were encouraging him to go in a particular direction?
Well, Barack Obama is no fool. He's a very bright person. But his entire life was formed by people with these views. So one of his greatest influences from his when he was about 9 years old to when he went off to college was a man named Frank Marshall Davis, who had been an old Stalinist, unrepentant, a Soviet tool all his life. And he's the one who mentored this fatherless young Barry Obama in Hawaii. So when Obama went from Hawaii to the continental U.S. to go to college, he identified with these radical groups, radical faculty, radical individuals, hung out with them. They were his social circles. And he has said before that he studied Marxism as a way of picking up girls. But really, he studied Marxism to master different theories and strategies and practices of how to go about radicalizing society for the purpose of fundamental transformation of that society and political power. So then by the time he got to Chicago and met with his fiance, Michelle Robinson, she was working for Valerie Jarrett, who was a senior person in the Chicago city government, but part of the Chicago political machine that had come out of the old Chicago Communist Party. So the two Obamas then, when Obama ultimately became president, brought Valerie Jarrett with them, and they still live in the same house today. So Jarrett was the real operational and organizational mind behind Obama and his transformational agenda. There were a whole lot of other of these drivers, to the point that when Obama was running for state office in the state of Illinois, he was trained and mentored and curated by a couple who had been part of the Weather Underground terrorist movement in the 1960s and 70s, but had then gone, quote, legitimate by being professors. When in reality, they were just as extremist as they always were. They just weren't committing crimes anymore.
Obama connected with Chicago, and Chicago known to be a base for disruptive transformational organizations.
Right. That was where the Communist Party was founded back in 1919. So they have very strong roots there. But the actual strain within the Democratic Party, because in the United States, the Communist Party has never been powerful at all. Its real influence has been not numerically for turning out votes, but in infiltrating institutions. And so this is where these different individuals who had devoted not just their own lives, but their parents had, and sometimes their grandparents had before them, come up through this party machine.
Yeah. What I started to find so interesting at this point, because it was Obama, you're also talking about Chicago in the book. And at the time, I was beginning to see things myself. I was particularly interested in a charity called Common Purpose, which supposedly was created after the then chief executive had been to Chicago. They come back to England, they suddenly can raise half a million pounds and create a charity, which to my mind became very political instantly. It was called Common Purpose. Maybe that's a bit close to Common Cause, which was operating in the States. But I began to look at that charity. And I also began to watch what was happening politically. And just pop a couple of slides on screen just to see what your reaction is to this. But Obama was there a little bit earlier. We'd had changes to left-wing politics in UK. So we'd had the Miliband brothers, Ed and David. And what was interesting about them was that their father had been interested in Marx and Marxist policy. But they were being put forward to be the new Labour leaders, or one of them was going to be the new Labour leader. And at the same time, we had Tony Blair emerging, and he was talking about a new form of left-wing politics. And that was something that I came across in your book at one particular point, where you talked about a change between sort of old left and new left. And immediately Tony Blair came into my mind. I'm just going to add a couple of little bits on this slide, because we had in Tony Blair's time, the Deputy Prime Minister Prescott, who was working with this very strange political charity, Common Purpose, from the office of the Deputy Prime Minister. But Prescott's own background was clearly linked to the communist viewpoint. That was a picture of him punching a member of the public in the face, so he wasn't messing around. And then later on, he basically lost all credibility when he'd been entertaining a lady actually in Westminster, so he was thrown out of politics. We also put this label on this particular slide back in 2015, the men destroying Britain in a chaos of wars, economic destruction, poverty, and, quote, Alinsky revolutionary change. But we were watching a background of Alinsky, who you mention in your book, being directly linked in with both the Labour Party in Britain and the Conservative Party. So what essentially in your book you're describing as this revolutionary change within America, we were also experiencing, people who could see were experiencing and seeing a similar revolutionary change in the UK happening at exactly the same time. And I feel that's unlikely to be a coincidence.
No, not at all. It's like the phenomenon now we have of wokeness and the real cultural self-destruction that's happening in both of our countries at the same time. But it's also happening in our own intelligence services at the same time. So if the story I wrote about the Intel and the FBI and the CIA, you could just as easily write about MI5 and MI6. Actually, my publisher cut out my MI6 chapter because he thought it would not be interesting to American audiences. But there you have an especially militant leadership, and you can see clearly that it's been run from the top down and not driven from the bottom up. But the rest of the Five Eyes, the Canadians, New Zealand, Australia, all those services are going through the same cultural transformation at the very same time that's highly at odds with the, you know, with their populations.
So, Mike, it gets fascinating now, doesn't it? Because we discussed a few minutes ago the fact that people inside the American intelligence services didn't appear to see this attack coming on them, and you gave lots of good reasons as to why they didn't tied up with their job just working in one particular area, whatever it is. But now we've got the interesting position that we've got the intelligence services in other Western countries who they've not picked up on this attack on them. They are themselves being subverted by it. So we go from the US to UK to Canada, wherever we want to go after that, and still we don't have any centralized intelligence service standing up and warning that clearly there's this revolutionary attack happening within society. That is a truly incredible a coincidence. Or we've got something which is much bigger than just America at work.
Very much. The Israeli secret services and their whole security apparatus are the same way as well. Very woke, or very, you know, culturally revolutionary. And I think someday in hindsight, people are going to look back and see that a lot of their wishful thinking that was through an ideological lens and not through a professional intelligence lens might have led to the ability of Iran and Hamas and others to attack the way they have been. This is one of the real dangers of of the extreme nature of these ideological changes. It's not simply, well, society has different views now, different values now, or at least elements of those societies do. But they're so militant about this and so intolerant about other views that it affects, it infects the whole idea of the collection and analysis of intelligence in an objective way to be able to inform national leadership to make decisions that are in each country's national interests. So if you throw out the rules of objectivity, or you throw out the rules of solid analysis and the competition of different points of view to try to arrive at proper conclusions, then you're destroying the entire value of having an intelligence service in the first place, and you're seeing it become weaponized now against your own societies or our own societies. Similarly, in law enforcement with the FBI, if you take the rules of evidence, and now it's not evidence based on fact, it's based on ideology, and you choose to disregard evidence for ideological reasons, or you invent evidence for ideological reasons, then you're destroying the whole idea of law enforcement and due process and then jurisprudence.
And one of the things that you mention in your book as part of the strategy is changes in language, to change language, words that are used, because this changes the way that people can or cannot form ideas themselves. So language and use of language is very much under attack as well.
Very much so, and especially the English language, because it's made up of so many other languages and has always so readily adapted other languages and other ideas. So you get other, say, more Latin-based languages where it's much harder, because now you have gendered words that don't fit the pronoun ideology that we're facing now. And so it's harder to penetrate those other groups, but especially in English, in the English-speaking countries, you have a corruption of language, which means it's not just new words coming up to describe new situations. It's the enforcement of new words to enforce an ideology. So, for example, in the FBI right now, if you mispronoun somebody as an FBI employee, you have three chances. On your third chance, it's considered a mark against you. And so going along with the revised pronouns, going along with not just simply being a good colleague and being a tolerant colleague and just saying, okay, well, that's your choice to be the way you identify yourself, but I'm just going to be a professional and just try to do my job. That's not enough in the FBI anymore. You have to be an advocate, or what they call an ally, to affirm this gender ideology. And if you do not, that's counted against you as part of your personnel record, and then your career is going to suffer. So this is sort of ideological warfare that's literally being waged through changing our entire language down to the grammar.
I want to put this one back on screen just because I think it's a lovely point. This was, again, another headline that we had in 2015. David Miliband, Labour, follows Barack Obama's lead on community organisation. And then at the bottom, it says the philosophy of political action theorized by the American activist Saul Alinsky in the 1930s and made more famous by Obama seeks to organize individuals into groups to better help them change their communities. It's aimed at politicians of all stripes as established parties struggle to retain members. So there was a deep warning in that little statement that even the framework of politics in UK was being broken down itself, and left or right was still talked about, but did they really mean anything? Because there was this new politics coming through with links back to Saul Alinsky. And if that was the Labour side, we'd also commented on the Conservative side. And this was headlined by Cameron Clegg, Saul Alinsky and Paulo Freire. And it says that basically the coalition government is going to use community organisers to play an important role in delivering what they call the big society by building community spirit. And when we looked at details of the big society to to me, and I think other probably people who were ex-military, it did seem to have a big communist component to it. So that was 2015. We're talking about Obama, we're talking about Saul Alinsky, and we're warning about deep changes to the political system, sort of making a synthesis of politics and the community as if it was one unit. And I presume that was because it meant that people were more easy to control in that format.
If you can organize people at the local level, you're doing it among people who know each other. They know where everybody lives. They belong to the same socioeconomic groups, but they're not organized because they're just living their lives. So if you come in as a community organizer, you're doing what Marx called, you know, raising their consciousness of their oppression, and that everything around them oppresses them, and they have to band together to fight their oppression and demand what's theirs. So this community organizing can sound very nice, but when you see the types of organizing that's being done and how people are mobilized, it's no surprise to see large numbers of radicalized people pour out into the streets and start demanding the overthrow of your system or your country. You know, we just noticed this in the past few days with the April 15th movement to shut down ports across the U.S. and around the world in 30 countries. And it's, you know, ordinary people don't do this, but if they've been organized to do it, they will do it. And most of them are not doing it in solidarity with Hamas terrorists or the Iranian regime. They're doing it because of what they see as the oppression of innocent people on the part of the Israelis. But the organizers know exactly what they're doing. They just don't tell the people who are being organized what they're doing.
I'm afraid we've got to let you go. You've got other engagements. I want to say straight away, we're only about halfway through the subject of your book and your subject. There was the whole subject of Hunter Biden and laptops and Biden himself and all of those serious issues within the FBI and the intelligence services in the US. Do you think you might manage to come back for part two with us?
Certainly.
It would be really wonderful. Okay, well, look, Mike, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to leave that hanging in the air for our audience, but we must have given them a lot to think about. And in a part two, I'd really like to explore with you not only the detail in your book, but also that if we've got this attack happening not only on the US, but countries in the Western Hemisphere in particular, maybe I could say worldwide, we should be able to get to the interesting point of saying, if the enemy's amongst us, how do we deal with it? But perhaps we could have a look at that in part two.
There's a lot there. Look forward to it.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.